Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is May 5th. Okay, we're going to finish up the cardiac output, blood flow, blood pressure chapter 14 today. Probably move on to respiratory chapter as well. All right, so what are the units of blood flow? Blood flow. It's a volume per time. Yeah, volume per time. So you could say, what, cubic centimeters, but that's equal to what, milliliters. And so flow is milliliters, mLs per minute. Okay, that's a measurement of flow. And what is flow equal to? We just wrote it on the board last time, I think. Flow. Right here, flow is equal to, what's the driving force for flow? So think of something that makes a fluid flow and then something that impedes the flow. So what makes a fluid go from one place to another? A pressure gradient, right? So, and as the pressure increases, what happens to the flow? It increases, so it's directly related, right? So we got pressure, so you could put down maybe delta P, for instance, if you wanted to. Okay, and what's going to impede that flow? Resistance, right? So that goes in the denominator right there. So flow is inversely related to resistance, but it is directly related to pressure. If pressure goes up, what happens to flow? Aha, wait a second, let's look. If it's directly related, if pressure goes up, what happens to flow? It goes up in a nice linear fashion, right? And if resistance goes up, what happens to flow? It goes down because it's inversely related. Yeah, that's really, really good. Okay, now what can you tell me about cardiac output? What are the units of cardiac output? Cardiac output is milliliters per minute. Oh, what does that sound like? Cardiac output is really what? It's really a flow, right? It's the amount of blood leaving the heart. So it's a flow. And what is cardiac output equal to? So you're going to have to memorize these equations. Petrification takes place. It's math. But it's not bad. It's just a couple parameters. Cardiac output is equal to, okay, so cardiac output is what? Milliliters, mLs per minute. Okay, so you could figure it out from there just by knowing the dimensions. It is heart rate. What is heart rate? Beats per minute. All right, heart rate times what? Stroke volume. And what is stroke volume? Amount of blood that the pump pumps every time it does what? It beats, right? So it is mLs per beat, right? So you can see these beats cancel out. We got milliliters per minute, which is what? Flow, which is equal to that right there. Okay, so we're going to use that relationship in a little bit, but we want to build upon this equation just a little bit. Let's look in particular at this resistance term right here. What determines the resistance of a fluid to flow through a tube? And what could you tell me, what does a cross-section of a tube look like? Does it look like that? Does it look like that? Does it look like this? Okay, does it look like that? So you got A, B, C, D. Oh, we could make up an E, but I think you get the idea. A tube looks like B, right? Okay, so the geometry of a tube helps determine what the flow properties are going to be like a little bit, but the tubes in our body have this kind of cross-section. All right, so let's look at Poiseuille's equation right here. Blood flow, all right, is going to be equal to delta P, which is what? The force, the driving force. And then this pi over 8 right here is just a constant. It's a really funny number because what can you tell me about the cross-section of tubes that we're interested in? What are they like? They're circular, right? So this term right here just means that due to the properties of the geometry of a tube, namely that the cross-section is circular, this is the kind of constant that we put in there. All right. And then what about this resistance to the fourth power over viscosity divided by the length of a blood vessel? Okay, so let's look at length of a blood vessel. If a blood vessel gets longer, what happens to blood flow? Yeah, it decreases, right? Because resistance All right, so let's just write resistance out. What is that equal to? It's equal to the length of the blood vessel times the viscosity, and I'm using this little term right here, viscosity, divided by the radius to the fourth power. Okay, so if we just look at resistance right here, if the length of the blood vessel increases, what happens to resistance? It increases, right? And then blood flow, because R is in the denominator, flow is going to decrease. Same thing about viscosity. If viscosity increases, what happens to resistance? It increases, but remember, resistance is in the numerator right here. So if resistance increases, the blood flow decreases. Now here is a really cool term that we're going to concentrate on. But let's go back to length right here. Can your body use changing the length of a blood vessel to adjust the flow through an organ? Can it use length of a blood vessel? They're fixed. The length of blood vessels in your body don't change, right? So that's not a method, a physiological method that your body can use to adjust blood flow. What about viscosity of the blood? Does your body use changes in viscosity of blood to adjust flow? Okay. How so? It does it only in the sense that it doesn't allow viscosity to wander very much. All right. It maintains it within a narrow range for homeostasis. Okay. So typically, your body does not adjust viscosity. All right. It likes to maintain it relatively low. Right, but it needs to maximize the number of red blood cells in your blood, and when your body does that, your viscosity goes way up, so there's an optimal number of red blood cells that you can have in your blood to carry oxygen without making this viscosity term too large, because that will decrease blood flow. So you know what? Typically, you don't regulate viscosity of your blood. It's pretty much constant throughout your whole lifespan. Okay, now what about radius? And remember what a radius is? What is radius? Yeah, it's just half of a diameter. It's from the center of a circle over to the edge right there. That's why we like that diagram. So radius, if you vasodilate, what happens to R? Does it get bigger or smaller if you vasodilate? It gets bigger, right? So let's look at this term right over here. If R gets bigger, what happens? If little r, if the radius gets bigger, sorry, if little radius gets big, what happens to resistance? It goes down, right? Because it's inversely related. But it's not just, according to Poiseuille's law, it's just not the radius of the blood vessel, it's what? Radius times the radius times the radius times the radius. So the fourth power rule. So a small change in the radius of a blood vessel will decrease the resistance dramatically. All right, and if the resistance goes down dramatically, what about flow? It increases dramatically, right? So that's how your body regulates blood flow through various organs, by adjusting vasoconstriction or vasodilation. All right, so that's why, how you got to become familiar with Poiseuille's law right here. Okay, so just think of this viscosity times length divided by radius is what? The resistance. So this is just, you know, your basic simple equation of flow equals delta P over R. And you got some fancy terms in there just to describe that the blood vessel is what? Circular in cross-section. Okay, mean arterial pressure and vascular resistance are the two major factors regulating blood flow, right? Because that's the pressure difference is the driving force, the resistance is the impeding force. And if we look at blood pressure across the whole cardiovascular system, okay, typically you might see a question, what type of blood vessel has the lowest blood pressure? And a lot of times people are going to say, oh, because you know, capillaries are special, a really special exchange takes place in the capillary. Maybe that has the lowest pressure. Okay, but remember, we're not thinking about exchange, we're just talking about blood flowing around through a complete circuit. It will always flow from high pressure to low, and when we look at this diagram right here, we see that capillaries don't have the lowest blood pressure. What does? Large veins, and probably even particular an atrium, a right atrium or a left atrium has the lowest pressure so that blood flows back to that part of the heart. All right, so the ventricle has a couple phases. Right, at 120 right here, what phase is the heart in when the pressure in a ventricle is 120 millimeters of mercury? That is systole, right? And then the heart relaxes, and what happens to the blood pressure? It goes all the way to zero, and then since it's zero, what can happen when pressure in the left ventricle is zero? This is really good in terms of what's going to happen when it starts to contract again. Why should the pressure in the ventricle be zero? Because it will allow the ventricle to fill up with blood again, right? So that's really handy. So it starts to fill up with blood again, and then it starts to contract, and then the pressure goes way up to 120 once again. Okay, large arteries like the aorta, the pressure doesn't go to zero, because not all of the blood can drain out of the aorta, all right, during a cardiac cycle, but it will reach peak systolic pressure. Okay, and like right around this region right here, this is the lowest blood pressure. We'll call this the diastolic pressure in the aorta. But let's think about the left ventricle. What's happening right here in the between the left ventricle and the aorta? Do you see? Can anybody tell me what's happening inside the heart or in the aorta right at this point? What's the pressure inside the left ventricle right here? It's 80, okay. And let's just say that the pressure in the aorta is 80. What can start to happen now? Especially, well, let's say maybe like right here. So now we have higher pressure in the left ventricle than the aorta. What happens? You have blood starts to flow out. So what has to happen? A valve has to open up. What valve is that that's opening up right here? That's the aortic semilunar valve. Okay, and the reason why this pressure here in the large arteries doesn't go to zero, what prevents it from going to zero? The aortic valve now closes, so that blood can't flow back into the ventricle because it's got zero pressure right here. Blood would flow from the aorta back into the ventricle. It can't, right, because of what? The aortic semilunar valve is closing right there. All right, so large arteries right here, we call these conducting arteries. It still contains this pressure pulse, and you still see this systolic pressure over diastolic pressure. Okay. In small arteries and arterioles, we see a decrease in pressure right here because these are resistance blood vessels. And so this is going to impede the flow of blood. All right. And then when we get into capillaries, again, we see a little decrease in blood pressure right here because there is resistance to blood flow through capillaries because they're so small. And then finally, we get into veins, and indeed in veins, that is the lowest blood pressure. So blood is going to flow from a left ventricle into a large vein because veins have the lowest blood pressure right there. Okay. Now, let's look at these graphs right here. Here we have kind of an illustration of an artery and then a capillary bed and then a vein right here. So we've got, if we're going to plot, we have centimeters per second, centimeters squared. This is a surface area, right? Like a regular piece of paper would be what? 8.5 by 11. Multiply those two numbers together, that would be what? Square inches. So this is a surface area. And if we look at the total cross-sectional area of an aorta, we see that it's relatively small to some other parts of the cardiovascular system. Capillaries are microscopically small, but because you have millions and millions and millions of them, when you add them all up together, right, this cross-sectional area of a capillary is huge, right? And then capillaries join together to form venules, and then venules and anastomose to form veins, and the veins come together to form the vena cava. And notice that the cross-sectional area goes back down. Well, here is a relationship between velocity and cross-sectional area that a fluid is going to flow through. All right, so what is velocity? What's the dimension for velocity? It's what, miles per hour? But in physiology, we're not doing miles per hour. We're doing what? Centimeters per second is probably a better term to use. So here is velocity of blood in each of these different divisions of the cardiovascular system. All right, now here is a good question, and that is, what vascular structure has the slowest velocity? And now you can say capillaries, and that you should be able to relate to exchange, right? Because in order for things to exchange through a capillary wall, it's got to spend some time in a capillary. If blood is just zipping through a capillary, even though a capillary is specialized for exchange, it doesn't have enough time for exchange to take place. All right, so we see that velocity of blood is slowest in capillaries because it has the highest, what? Cross-sectional area. All right, so on this graph right here, you might want to put cross-section, and then down on the second graph right over here, just say velocity. All right, so make sure you know the difference between velocity and blood pressure. So what blood vessel has the slowest velocity? A capillary. And which kind of blood vessel has the lowest pressure? Would be the veins. Yeah, or you could say an atrium if you wanted to. Okay, and make sure you get a feeling that those are two different kinds of things. All right, so blood pressure we're really interested in, okay, because blood pressure is going to help determine blood flow through your body. And, of course, blood flow is real important because what is blood doing? It's delivering something, like oxygen, right? So that mitochondria can make ATP. So this is really important. All right, so we're about ready to be able to understand the last couple of days' lectures, I think, pretty soon. All right, so arterioles play a role in distributing blood and controlling blood pressure, okay, because these arterioles can vasoconstrict or vasodilate. All right, so let's look at this little model right here. We have kind of like a glass tube with a bunch of little chimneys sticking off of it right here, and if we pour a lot of blood in this big reservoir right here, gravity is going to pull down on it and produce pressure, which then is going to make this fluid flow out of this container down this tube, and it will even push fluid up these little chimneys right here, okay, due to that pressure. So that if we completely block off, with this little thumb wheel right here, if we completely block off this site, what's going to happen to the level of blood in these two little chimneys compared to the big reservoir right here? Can you see that they're going to be exactly the same? Okay, they're going to fill up to exactly the same level. So the pressure over here and the pressure over here is going to be the same as over here if we decrease the radius so much that we prevent flow, right? So what are we doing? We're increasing the resistance through this region right here. So when we increase resistance right here, what happens to pressure in these upstream vessels right here? It goes up, right? It increases. I don't know if you can see that or not, but let's now decrease the resistance by loosening up this little thumb wheel, so now that fluid can flow through here. What happens to the pressure in these two side little chimneys right here? They start to go down, right? So this little constriction can adjust blood pressure in blood vessels in front of it, proximal to it. And of course, if we let fluid to flow through this, then it's going to also fill this other chamber. Right, but to a lesser degree because there's less pressure over here because of this resistance. All right, so capillary blood pressure is decreased because they are downstream of these high resistance arterioles, and you have these arterioles all over the body, and they can constrict or vasodilate and thereby take blood from one organ and give it to another depending on the metabolic demands of those particular organs. Okay, so here is just kind of another diagram that shows the cross-sectional area of capillaries is very, very high, and the pressure is decreasing because of resistance through these smaller blood vessels right here. That's what this basically says. Okay, so this probably might be the most important slide in order to understand the cardiovascular system, all right? And blood pressure is controlled mainly by heart rate, the stroke volume, and peripheral resistance. And when I say peripheral resistance, I want you just to think of resistance to blood flow. So this term right here, right, you got flow is equal to delta P over R. We could kind of rewrite this equation right here. What is this delta P in everyday kind of language? It's just the blood pressure in your body. So how about if I just say BP right here for blood pressure? And this resistance is resistance to flow. The fancy term, what's the fancy term for resistance to flow? Peripheral resistance, or we could say total peripheral resistance. It just goes all by the same name. So maybe I'll put total peripheral resistance of all resistance in blood vessels, TPR. Okay. And that's not very intuitive, how these factors affect blood pressure, right? And this basically just says that blood pressure is directly related to heart rate. So that if heart rate increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases. Okay, maybe you have an intuitive feel for that. What about contractility of the heart? As stroke volume increases, what's going to happen to blood pressure? It's going to increase. Now here's a really strange one. What happens to blood pressure if peripheral resistance increases? Okay, I want you to be able to see that it's directly related to blood pressure. So that if resistance increases, so does blood pressure. So that's one way that your body can maintain blood pressure, is by increasing resistance. So what is a nice way of looking at that? All right, so here we have flow is equal to what? Blood pressure over resistance, right? But what else is, what is blood flow equal to? Cardiac output. What's cardiac output? Heart rate times stroke volume. So since these are both equal to flow, what can we say? We can say that BP, which is blood pressure, divided by total peripheral resistance is equal to what? Cardiac outrate, cardiac output, which is what? Heart rate times stroke volume. All right, that's still a little bit messy, so let's simplify the equation. What do we want to do? Move the resistance over to the other side of the equation, and what do you end up with? Blood pressure is equal to heart rate times stroke volume times total peripheral resistance. Okay, so now maybe it gets a little bit more intuitive for you. But if it doesn't, just memorize that equation, because what does this say? This just says that heart rate and stroke volume and resistance are what? Directly related to blood pressure. Which means that if resistance goes up and everything else remains constant, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. If heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up. And if they all go up, then blood pressure goes up what? In a big way. Okay. So this is a really handy equation to remember, and if you want to just derive it like that, then probably you'll never forget it. So that's really nice. All right, so sympathoadrenal activity raises blood pressure via arteriolar vasoconstriction. And as you constrict a blood vessel, what happens to resistance? It goes up, and if resistance goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up as well. Okay? And of course, sympathoadrenal activity is just what? Increasing sympathetic tone. Sometimes we just call that sympathetic tone. Kidneys play a role in regulating blood pressure by regulating blood volume. Now how on earth, let's go back, that relates to our previous lecture a little bit. How does increasing blood volume affect blood pressure? If you increase blood volume, maybe a simple way to think about it, but let's think of a good physiologic reason first. If blood volume increases, what about venous return? What happens to blood flow back to the heart? It increases. So what does the heart do? Does it shrink down or does it expand a little more? Expand. So end-diastolic volume increases. All right, and then what about that intrinsic property of the heart when end-diastolic volume goes up? If it's a normal heart, contraction goes up, right, because of the Frank-Starling law. So as venous return goes up and diastolic volume goes up, the heart contracts with more vigor, so stroke volume increases. And if stroke volume increases, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up because it's directly related to it. Okay, so that's particularly handy to understand even how the kidney affects blood pressure by regulating blood volume. Okay, another way of thinking about this, which is how I think about it sometimes. Okay, if you have a tire and it's flat, what do you do to increase the pressure? Do you take air out or do you put air in? You put air in. So you can almost use that analogy in terms of your cardiovascular system. If your blood pressure is low, what would you do? Take blood out or put blood in? Yeah, you put blood in. Okay, but the first mechanism is a nice physiologic way of looking at it as well. Okay, so I got a question for you. What is the mechanism, the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure in the long term, from day to day, week to week, even month to month? What is that mechanism called? All right, it's a feedback mechanism. The renin angiotensin aldosterone mechanism, right? So you got to know that one. You should be able to draw that one out just on a blank piece of paper so you don't forget that one. All right, so that's for long-term regulation of blood pressure. But that doesn't help you in the short term, like right after lecture when you get up to run out to the beach because it's going to be a really nice weekend, okay? Well, as soon as you stand up, your blood pressure is going to drop. And if you got to wait around for a day or two for the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism to take effect to get your blood pressure back up to where it should be, you're going to miss all the nice things over the weekend, right? So there's got to be something that adjusts your blood pressure rapidly, and it is the baroreceptor reflex. This is the most important mechanism for fast regulation of blood pressure, okay? And so it's activated by changes in blood pressure. They're detected by receptors. Of course, you can't sense a particular modality of energy in your body or outside your body if you don't have a receptor for it. These are stretch receptors located in the arch of the aorta and in the carotid sinus. So go ahead, show me where your carotid sinus is. Use two hands. Where's your carotid sinus at? You're not using two hands. Okay, right here. I said two hands because if you press on them really hard, it might cause you to faint. Okay? So everybody's not going to do that. Right, so the carotid sinus is what? At the junction of the common carotid to the internal and external. That bifurcation right there, there's like a little bulge, and there are stretch receptors. There's also some other chemoreceptors in there as well. All right, and as your blood pressure goes up, your blood vessels stretch a little bit, right? Like if we increase pressure in a balloon, what happens to a balloon? Does it shrink down or expand? It expands, right? So these stretch receptors then send signals to the vasomotor center and cardioregulatory center in the medulla to let your central nervous system know what your blood pressure is. All right, so increases in blood pressure cause the walls of that carotid sinus to stretch and increase, and as these receptors stretch, they send more action potentials to the medulla, right, or the train, or the frequency of action potentials, right? But it's most sensitive to sudden decreases in blood pressure or sudden changes in blood pressure, right? So it's a phasic kind of receptor. So here is some anatomy of the baroreceptor reflex. Okay, so here is the carotid cell. Oh, that's a nice picture. I forgot we had a nice picture. Is this in your book? I guess, huh? Oh, that's nice. A physiology book with a little anatomy. That's nice. So here is the carotid sinus. You can see this little bulb right here. So here is the external. Here's the internal carotid, right, coming right here in the common carotid artery. And, you know, there's a lot of pathology associated with this carotid sinus right here because of the structure of it. There's some really strange flow and pressure abnormalities right here that can cause the walls of these blood vessels to degenerate a little bit and form thrombus or plaques. All right, and if there's a little plaque of calcium or cholesterol right here in the carotid sinus and it breaks off, where is it going to go? There's a really good chance it's going to go to the brain. And is that a big deal? Yeah, because it's going to cause a stroke, right? So that part of the brain that gets occluded is going to die, right, after how long? Yeah, about 3 minutes, right? So not much time to mess around with that. All right, so this is the most commonly imaged area in the body. I don't have any statistics with that. That's just my impression, all right, because this is just prone to disease. All right, but it does have baroreceptors, which then send signals to, here's the medulla oblongata, so here's the vasomotor center. And what does the vasomotor center have? Think of your response loop, right? So here's a stimulus affecting these receptors. Here's an afferent pathway bringing signals into what? An integration center. And what does an integration center have? It has a set point. It has what your proper blood pressure should be. So it compares what your blood pressure is to what it should be. And if they're exactly the same, if those numbers are the same, what is the decision that the integration center does? It says, oh, things are fine. Nothing has to change, right? But, for instance, if you stand up, your blood pressure drops and that information reaches the vasomotor center right here, does it say everything's fine? It says, there's an error in blood pressure. It's too low. So what's going to happen now? It's through some negative feedback mechanism, your blood pressure is going to increase. So how can you increase blood pressure? How could you increase blood pressure? changing heart rate, right? By increasing heart rate, increasing stroke volume, or increasing resistance, total peripheral resistance. And how do you increase resistance in blood vessels? You cause vasoconstriction, right? All right, so let's take a look and see if that can happen. All right, so it looks like we have some colors right here. I don't think the colors are really... Oh, yeah. The colors like blue is parasympathetic, and sympathetic is red outflow, right? So we got two different kinds of outflow. Remember, parasympathetic is what kind of outflow? In terms of your anatomy, how does it leave your central nervous system? It is? It's on the tip of your tongue, I can tell. It is what? Craniosacral, right? So it leaves the brain. Oh, what's an important nerve? Tell me one nerve that it can leave. Like the vagus nerve, number 10. Right? But sympathetic outflow is what? Thoracolumbar, so it's not going to leave the cranial nerve. So here we can see leaving through the sympathetic chain in some region of the thorax right here. All right, so if your blood pressure is low, what might be a good decision that the medulla makes in terms of blood vessels? We don't have blood vessels on here, but we should maybe draw one in. We have the heart. What's it going to do to the heart? Sympathetic outflow, if your blood pressure is too low, it's going to stimulate the SA node and AV node, speed up the pacemaker of the heart, right? And conduction through the fibrous myocardium right here, fibrous skeleton of the heart. And if we stimulate the SA node with sympathetic stimulation, what is that going to change? Chronotropy of the heart, which is what? Heart rate. What happens to heart rate? It's going to increase heart rate. And what's going to happen to blood pressure? Increase, and does that add or subtract to the initial stimulus? Which was the initial stimulus? We said, oh, you're going to stand up, your blood pressure is going to drop. Right? So it subtracts. So what kind of feedback response is that? Response loop? That's a nice negative feedback loop. Right? Sympathetic outflow not only goes to the nodal tissue, but it also goes to the contractile tissues of the atrium and the ventricles. Right? Causes a higher... A force of contraction, more contractility in the heart. What's the effect on blood pressure there? That's going to increase stroke volume, and if stroke volume increases, it's directly related to blood pressure. So again, blood pressure is going to increase. All right. What you don't see right here, oh, too bad I can't draw. Probably could. All right. But here's another nerve going to a blood vessel, and it's going to cause blood vessels to do what? To constrict, vasoconstrict, and when they constrict, what happens to resistance? As the radius decreases, resistance goes way up, right? So total peripheral resistance goes up. What happens to blood pressure? It goes up as well. So all of these effects subtract from the initial stimulus, right? So this is a very nice and easy way to regulate your blood pressure in the short term. So this is the baroreceptor reflex. So you have receptors in the carotid sinus and the arch of the aorta that can work through either the parasympathetic or the sympathetic nervous system to either raise or lower blood pressure. Okay, so here's an exam figure. I don't think this is this one right here. I don't think this is an exam figure, but this one is. And so this is nice. All right, so going from a prone position to a standing position. All right, you're going to have less venous return to the heart. Blood is going to pool in your extremities. It's not going to just automatically jump up to your heart just because you stand up. So you're going to have less venous return to the heart, which means your heart's not going to fill quite as much. So end-diastolic volume goes down. When end-diastolic volume goes down, what happens to contractility of the heart? It decreases because why? That's the Frank Starling law, right? As you don't stretch the myocardium out, it gets weaker. And if stroke volume goes down, what happens to blood pressure? It goes down, right? And if it goes down enough, you lose consciousness. All right, so cardiac output goes down, blood pressure goes down. That's the stimulus for this response loop, but it gets to the baroreceptors. So baroreceptors are the sensory receptors. Here's the afferent pathway to the medulla. This is the cardioregulatory center, and it says blood pressure is too low. What I decide to do is increase sympathetic tone, decrease parasympathetic tone. So what happens? Vasoconstriction of arteries. Total peripheral resistance increases. So we see that increases blood pressure. Yes, it does. And cardiac rate goes up. Okay, cardiac output goes up as well. But they're missing a little arrow over here because what? Not only does the heart rate go up, but sympathetic nerves go to the myocardium as well, the ventricles, it increases stroke volume. So three reasons why blood pressure will go up. And what was the initial stimulus? A decrease in blood pressure right here. So this is a nice negative feedback loop. Okay. Oh, well, this chapter was so much fun. It's over. Okay, so here's the baroreceptor reflex. For what? What kind of regulation of blood pressure? That's right. Second to second, right? Use this equation right here. But for long-term regulation of blood pressure, what do you have to be aware of? Some hormones, right? And that makes sense. Fast response loops rely on the nervous system. Slow response loops for long-term regulation rely on, endocrine system for that. Okay, so that makes perfect sense. Okay, so we can stop that chapter. Unless you have some questions. Okay? That's good, huh? All right, so let's see, what can I do here? I need to find the X. Respiratory lecture. Okay, some of this is review from anatomy. Respiration can mean a lot of different things. Like cellular let me get my cursor working here again. Okay, respiration could mean cellular respiration. What the heck is cellular respiration? Like something in a cell. What's happening in a cell? How a cell uses oxygen to do what? To make ATP. As a matter of fact, the cell doesn't do that, but what does that inside of a cell? Mitochondria in particular. And you guys should know a lot about cellular respiration right now. Right? Some respiratory intermediates and different parts in the mitochondria that do different things and even different parts in the cytoplasm. Okay, but it also means ventilation, moving air in and out of your lungs. Just the act of breathing, inhaling and exhaling also relates to respiration. And gas exchange, here's the third thing, gas exchange in the lungs going into blood, and then these gases that are in the blood exchanging with tissue spaces. All right, so what kind of blood vessel does this require? Gas exchange. You need capillaries, that's right, because that's the only kind of blood vessel where exchange takes place. All right, so ventilation moves air in and out of the lungs. Sometimes we call that external respiration. Gas exchange between blood and tissues, right? Sometimes we call that internal respiration. And gas will only move, like oxygen or CO2, due to diffusion. And that is what? A passive process. So how do these molecules move? From where to where? High what? High concentration to low concentration. Kind of analogous to pressure, okay? Alright, so if oxygen is going to move into your body, where does oxygen concentration have to be the highest? Outside. Otherwise it's never going to move in, right? So it's just by concentration gradient. And if CO2 is going to leave your body, where does it have to be the lowest? Outside. Once again, in the air. Right? And the concentration of CO2 in the air is almost zero. So there's a huge concentration gradient, so it's really easy to get rid of that substance. And since your body is using up oxygen, that provides a really good, very steep concentration gradient from outside in the air to inside your body. Okay, so some respiratory structures, right? You've got an upper respiratory tract. This is a really fast review, which is what? Your nasal cavity, oral cavity, and part of the pharynx, like nasopharynx, oropharynx, that's your upper respiratory tract. And starting with the larynx, that's your lower respiratory tract, and that has cartilage in it, and that cartilage holds these airways open all the time so that they are never compressed, they never constrict, because what would happen to airflow if they were to constrict? Remember Poiseuille's law? You could use it for air as well. Then you won't have airflow through these tubes, and what do we call that if you don't have air flow through these tubes? We call that choking. Okay? Somebody maybe said a more proper term, but if you can't breathe, we call that choking. Okay, so here's the trachea, and then we have a right lung and left lung. After this first bifurcation, you got a primary bronchus, right? And then another bifurcation, secondary bronchus. And finally, You get to different lobes of the lung, and then these airways get smaller and smaller and smaller until we get to something called a bronchiole. And a bronchiole is a microscopic structure that does not have any cartilage on it. That's basically the definition of a bronchiole. So when I look at these bronchioles right here, I don't see any cartilage. But it does have smooth muscle, which can constrict or dilate. And I think you know what kind of adrenergic receptors are in those smooth muscles right there. Does anybody remember what kind of adrenergic receptor? An adrenergic receptor responds to what kind of stimulus? What kind of hormone? Like norepinephrine or epinephrine, right, can stimulate an adrenergic receptor. And remember, you got alpha and beta. What kind of receptors? Oh, I tested you on this already. What kind of receptors? It's a beta receptor of what kind? Two. That's a beta 2 receptor, right, which inhibits these muscles, which then dilates the airways, allows you to breathe. Okay. But on some of these bronchioles, when they bifurcate even more, I see these little pouches or pockets right here, and this thing is just a spherical structure. We usually call that an alveolus in anatomy. So here is an alveoli, here is an alveoli. These are the structures that are specialized for exchange because on the outside there's going to be a capillary network. So even in some of these bronchioles, before it gets to an alveolar sac right here, which might have 50 or 100 of these various alveoli, okay, these respiratory bronchioles are the first places in the lung where exchange can take place because there's an alveolus with an associated capillary bed around it. Okay. All right, but this right here is where most of the gas exchange takes place, in this alveolar sac right here. And I didn't bring a ruler down. I brought some stuff, but I forgot a ruler. Okay, let's take all of these alveoli, okay? And so we got 8 million of these alveolar sacs, and basically we have about 300 million alveoli in a lung. And let's take an alveolus and think that it's a grape and peel the skin on a grape and flatten it out on a piece of, on a tabletop. And let's take the next alveolus, skin it like a grape and flatten it out on a tabletop and fill in all the spaces, all right, until the tabletop is all filled in with these alveoli right here. Ah, here's a ruler. Fantastic. Okay. So, what do we call like a piece of paper like, you know what, I'm going to use a door. What can you tell me about, what am I measuring right here? Here's the width of a door. Look, it's exactly 1 meter. Okay. And the height is what? It is exactly 2 meters. That's really nice. All right, so we can calculate this area of the doorway, right? And in physiology, we're going to call that surface area, right? And with this surface area right here, or this doorway, how many people can get through it at one time? Maybe two or three, four if they get a running start and they all kind of pop through at one time, okay? All right, so with 2 square meters, right, you calculate the surface areas, multiply the width times the height. So this is a nice pedestrian door, maybe 4 people at one time. But now consider a garage door for a car, and it has a much greater surface area. What about the number of people that can go through that doorway at one time? Is it 4? Oh, it's probably going to be like 40 or 50 or even more than that, right? And if they get a running start, maybe 100, right, popping through all at one time. All right, so when we think of surface area, which is what, width times height, I want you to think in your mind, what? What's that thing there? That is a? That's a doorway, and what's the function of a doorway? In one word, what's the function of a capillary? Exchange, right? So a function of a doorway is exchange, so people can go from one room into another. All right, so getting back to the lung right here, if we take all of these alveoli that are in the lung and put it on a flat surface, we can measure the surface area for what? Exchange, right? And since you have living processes that need oxygen, what should that surface area be? Small or should it be large? It should be large. And if we were to take a ruler, right, that we measured 2 square meters right there, if we were to look at the alveoli, it would be 70 square meters. And that's only 2 right there. And to give you an idea of what 70 square meters is, that's about half of a tennis court. So that's the surface area for exchange in your lungs, which is pretty amazing. And through evolution, that surface area has been folded in on itself in this kind of spherical pattern right here so that it fits inside your body in a small space. And personally, I find that very appealing because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall, right? So it's really good. I really like the lungs a lot. Okay. So a huge surface area for exchange. Okay, so we have a conducting zone. This is where exchange cannot take place. And then we have the respiratory zone where we have these alveoli right here. Okay, and if we look at just a nice, this is a really zoomed in region of an alveolus. All right, we see air inside this little pocket right here. And here is the wall of the alveolus. And so here is a space. What kind of tissue lines a space or a cavity? Yeah, what kind of tissue? Oh, how many tissues are there in the body? There's four. What are they really fast? They're epithelium is one. There's connective tissue, muscle and nervous tissue. All right, so what kind of tissue is this right here? That's an epithelium, right? So here's an epithelium because that's its job to line a cavity or cover a surface. So it's covering this surface right here, or if you think an alveolus as a cavity, it's lining this cavity. Now, what kind of epithelium is that? Because you can classify epithelium by structure. It's just what? A nice, simple, squamous epithelium. And what is that specialized to do? Exchange, right? Just like the wall of a capillary is a simple squamous epithelium, it's specialized for exchange. So here is the wall of the alveolus specialized for exchange. And we see this is a type 1 alveolar cell right here that makes up the wall. Here is a type 2 alveolar cell. It's secreting a product onto the surface of this alveolus right here, which I'm going to maybe talk about in just a little bit. Third kind of cell we have is a macrophage. And what's the job of a macrophage? Yeah, it's immune response, right? It's part of your immune system. It's a shapeshifter. It can crawl around all through your body. It starts off in the blood as a monocyte, and then when it leaves the blood, we call it a macrophage. That just means a big eater. It just phagocytizes and then lyses things that don't belong in your body, can identify antigens. Where do you have antigens? Cell surface, that's right. All cells have antigens of some kind, and this macrophage can recognize your cells from foreign cells. And then it crawls back into the blood and takes it to a lymph node someplace so that your lymphatic system can design a really nice, effective killing machine to kill those kinds of bacteria or viruses or whatever that you breathed in your body. All right, so where does oxygen have to diffuse from? Air inside the alveolus into the blood right here. So it's got to go through the wall of the alveolus. It's got to go through this little interstitial space right here. There's some connective tissue, which is really thin. And then the wall of the capillary, and then where is oxygen? It's inside the blood. So the wall of the alveolus, the small interstitial space, and the wall of the capillary is sometimes what we call the respiratory membrane. All right, so jot down, respiratory membrane is the wall of the capillary, interstitial space, and wall of the alveolus. So two thin cells and a little interstitial space. Okay, so these alveoli are sort of spherically shaped. They're clustered at the ends of respiratory bronchioles, and they form like a honeycomb unit inside the lung. And as a matter of fact, air in one cluster can pass through others to other alveoli through alveolar pores. And I don't see an alveolar pore on this slide. Maybe there's one over here. No, there isn't. Okay. Probably I'll mention it when we get to another slide of it. So the conducting zone just takes air from, say, your nasal cavity, all right, so some in your pharynx, down into the larynx, and then finally into the lungs. So what can you tell me about exchange, gas exchange, in these structures right here? The larynx, the trachea, right, the main bronchus, secondary bronchus, tertiary bronchus, all right? So it just distributes air to your lungs, but no exchange can take place. And this has kind of a special lining. Oh, it's good we mentioned epithelia, because what kind of lining do we find right here in the larynx and the trachea? It's an epithelium, but what kind of epithelium in particular? Yeah, it's a really nifty one. It's what, that pseudostratified ciliated columnar. So it's a ciliated epithelium, and the cilia are beating or sweeping. They're important for motility. And which way are they sweeping? They're sweeping up, because also in that epithelium you have a lot of goblet cells, which are secreting mucus that surround the cilia that traps dust particles. And those dust particles then don't go down into your lungs and plug your lungs up. The cilia sweep all that dust up into your pharynx, and then finally your oral cavity. And then what do? Yeah, you just swallow it down. Unless what? Unless you're a baseball player. And then what do you do? Plenty of opportunity to spit it out. Okay, so that's just a nice mechanism. That's part of your immune system, but that's just mechanical. That's just a mechanical way that your body helps take care of itself. Okay, thoracic cavity. The inferior boundary is the diaphragm. It's kind of dome-shaped when it's relaxed. And when it contracts, it goes from a dome shape to a flat shape, right? And then because muscle, one of the properties of muscle is elasticity. When it relaxes, it goes back to its original shape, which is what? Like a dome, all right? So your diaphragm is doing this all the time. Indeed, thoracic cavity contains the heart, large blood vessels, all that kind of stuff, okay? Below the thoracic cavity is the abdominal pelvic cavity. That helps in breathing sometimes under certain circumstances, and we'll mention that. Okay, so here are the lungs. What cavity are the lungs in? And there's a bunch of correct answers. You could say what? Ventral cavity, but that's not really pertinent to our discussion. You could also say thoracic cavity, but that's, again, not really pertinent to our discussion right here. It's what? The pleural cavity. Okay, so here are the lungs in the pleural cavity right here. That just means the cavity that the lungs are in. So pleural cavity is what? A subcavity of thoracic cavity. Thoracic is a subcavity of the ventral body cavity. And the outside of the inside of the lungs, those alveoli, of course, are connected to the outside world via these bronchi. But what about the outside of the lung? Is the outside of the lung connected to the outside world? It is not. So there are different kinds of membranes, right? There's a membrane that covers a surface connected to the outside world. What kind of membrane is that? Membrane that's connected to the outside, like your oral cavity. What kind of membrane is the lining of your mouth, the lining of your respiratory tract, the lining of your digestive tract, lining of the reproductive tract? They're all open to the outside world, so that is a mucous membrane, right? Sometimes it secretes mucus, but not in every particular case. But the pleural cavity does not have a mucous membrane on it because it's not open to the outside world. What kind of membrane is that? That is a serous membrane, right? So how many divisions does the serous membrane have? It's got three important divisions. And the membrane that's right on the surface of the visceral organ, I can't zoom in, all right, but it probably has a color to it, like blue or something. Okay, here's a membrane right on the surface of the lung. As a part of the serous membrane, we call that the visceral pleura, or serous membrane around the lung. All right, so here's visceral pleura, and then there's a space filled with serous fluid. Okay, and then if we go all the way around to the side over here, we see that it's continuous, all right, and eventually becomes in contact with the thoracic wall. All right, so that's another part of the serous membrane, but we call that the parietal division. So you got parietal serous membrane, you've got the serous fluid and the serous cavity or pleural space, and then you've got the viscera pleura right here, or the visceral serous membrane on the lung. So you have these three membranes on the heart right here. All right, so let's talk about some things about ventilation. One thing I want to talk about, this serous fluid right here is basically water. It's a watery kind of serous fluid. And what can you tell me about water? Is it sticky or is it slippery? Okay, and it's a really trick question. And I'll answer it right now, but we'll have to look and prove it to ourselves that water is really sticky. If there is water on that linoleum floor over there, of course, you're going to slip on it. Okay, But essentially, water is very sticky. Maybe you've had a couple of plates at home after you've washed them, okay, and they have water between them, some saucers for coffee cups or something, and there's water between them. You can pick up the top saucer or top plate, and what's going to happen to the bottom plate? It's going to stick to it, okay, because of what we call surface tension. So because there's water in this interpleural space right here, the wall of the lung likes to stick to the wall of the thorax. All right, so that's basically the concept that I want you to see right there. All right, so ventilation results from pressure changes. I guess that's pretty straightforward, induced by changes in lung volume. So how does air move? From high pressure to low pressure. Okay, and the lungs has a couple of these properties right here. Compliance, elasticity, and surface tension influence how ventilation works. Compliance just means that when there is a small change in pressure, there's going to be a large change in volume. So it's easy to make the lung change volume by making small changes in pressure. Elasticity just means that after you stretch the lungs out, guess what happens? They go back to their original condition, okay, because they're elastic. And surface tension is going to play some important roles for us, and I'll show you how that works. Okay, in just a little bit. Okay, so the visceral and parietal pleura, right, that we defined over here, normally adhere to each other so that the lung remains in contact with the chest wall. And so when the thoracic cavity expands, guess what that does? That helps expand the lungs, right? So that's a really handy feature as a result, right? But even more importantly, and because why? That water in there, that serous fluid is sticky. But even more importantly, the reason why air flows into the lungs is because of pressure changes. All right, during inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure is about -3 millimeters of mercury. During expiration, it's about +3. And so these are small pressures that either add to or subtract from atmospheric pressure. All right, so we're going to use atmospheric pressure as being like zero, even though everybody kind of knows it's at 760 millimeters of mercury. A positive transmural pressure keeps the lungs inflated all the time. Okay, so they don't collapse completely. And as a matter of fact, if somebody has a puncture of their thoracic cavity to where this transmural pressure goes to zero, what do we call that condition? That's what we call a collapsed lung. It actually completely collapses because of the elasticity of the lung tissue. Okay, so, oops. On inspiration, okay, the important thing that I want you to see right here is this number right here, the intrapulmonary pressure, above and below atmospheric pressure. So on inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure, which is the pressure inside the lungs, is less than atmospheric pressure by 3 millimeters of mercury. So if it's less than atmospheric pressure, what happens to air? It flows in. Okay. On expiration, the intrapulmonary pressure is higher than atmospheric pressure, so what happens to air? It's going to flow out. All right. So let's look at the mechanism, right, that changes this intrapulmonary pressure a little bit. And that's due to Boyle's law. All right, so here is another little equation for you, but you're handy with these kinds of equations right now. What can you tell me about the relationship of Boyle's law between pressure and volume? Okay, what's the relationship? Directly related? Indirect. No, it's inversely related. Or, yeah, you could say indirect, but maybe inverse is a little bit better. Okay, maybe inverse is a little bit better. So that if the volume goes down, what happens to pressure? The pressure goes up. Or if the volume goes up, what happens to pressure? It goes the other way, right? Okay. All right, so this implies that changes in intrapulmonary pressure occur as a result of changes in lung volume, and that is really, really true. All right, so the way that we inhale is by changing the size of our thorax. So an increase in lung volume decreases intrapulmonary pressure. That causes inspiration. A decrease in lung volume raises intrapulmonary pressure that causes expiration. And sometimes we use muscles for that to happen. All right, and remember, compliance is just a state of the lungs that says that small changes in pressure can cause large changes in lung volume, at least for the healthy lung. Okay, elasticity. right, is the tendency to return to its initial size. And around every alveolus, there is a network of elastic proteins or elastic fibers. So at the end of inspiration, when an alveolus is expanded, okay, how much work does it take to get the alveolus to go back to its original shape? Does it take any muscle to squeeze it out, to squeeze it back down? No, because of all those elastic fibers. All right, so expiration, a certain kind of expiration, is passive. It just relies on these elastic proteins right here. So elastic tension increases during inspiration, right, and is reduced by recoil during expiration. So inhalation is active. It requires a muscle to increase the size of the thoracic cavity. Air flows into the lungs. Right? Expiration, at least for the kind of breathing that we're doing right now, which is what we call quiet breathing, is a completely passive process. Just by the process of relaxing the diaphragm, air is going to flow out of your lungs for two reasons, but they're both elastic reasons. One elastic reason is what? The alveolus is elastic. It's going to shrink back down. And the other thing is, what about skeletal muscle? Does it have elastic properties? It does as well. It's one property of muscle. So after the diaphragm contracts and becomes flat, when it relaxes, it goes back to being kind of a dome-shaped again, and that forces air out of your lungs. Okay, so here is kind of a good example of that. Maybe you play around with this in lab. Here is just a little device. The little balloons in there are your lungs, and we can inflate them and deflate them. And here's a little nostril right there. All right, and I can see some the primary main bronchi and a little trachea. And then we have the thoracic cavity, and this black rubber piece is going to represent the diaphragm. So at rest, the diaphragm is poking up into the thoracic cavity, and when the diaphragm contracts, what happens to it? It gets pulled inferiorly, and when it gets pulled inferiorly, what happens to the volume of this bell right here? The volume increases, all right? And according to Boyle's law, if the volume increases, what happens to pressure? It decreases. It decreases below atmospheric pressure. So if there's low pressure inside here and high in the air, then air is going to flow from the air into these little balloons right here. That's the theory. So do you think that might work? I hope it's going to work, if I can hold it enough without clogging it up. All right, so we're going to depress the diaphragm. Oh, look what happens to the lungs. All right, so they inflate. And as the volume decreases, the pressure increases, and the lungs deflate. Okay, so that's a pretty good example of how the lungs operate. Okay, but here is maybe a better example too. That's just due to the diaphragm. All right, so here I have an alveolus, and over here I have an alveolus. I have two little chambers right here, and I want you to tell me which one is a better example of an alveolus. Okay, and they're both going to inflate. All right, so here is, you can see I'm well prepared for Cinco de Mayo. On the way to school, I stopped and picked up a bag. Okay, so on inspiration, this alveolus is going to inflate, right? All right, so it is inflated right here, and then we're going to relax. What's going to happen to air inside this alveolus right here? Does this bag have any elastic properties? It's diseased. It hasn't got a single bit of elastic fiber left in it. All right, so if I let go, what's going to happen? It's not going to deflate. All right, so we have air stuck in that alveolus right there. And that's kind of a terrible situation to be in because this person would like to inhale again, right? Can that person inhale again? No, because the lungs are filled up with air. It's a miserable condition to be in. Okay, now here's another kind of alveolus, but this balloon is really old. We'll see if it still works. Okay, that's good. It didn't pop. That's really good. Okay. And so this could be another example of an alveolus right here. Okay, and when I relax, what's going to happen to this alveolus right here? Oh, sorry. Okay, what's going to happen to this alveolus? It's going to... Well, not in such a dramatic way, but it's getting old. Air is really forced out of that alveolus by what? The elastic properties. Okay, so here is a nice diseased alveolus. There's a nice healthy alveolus right there. All right, so exhalation is passive. All right, so when we come back, we're going to talk about surface tension right here.